This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
In which we triangulate the stock market, the actual economy, and one presidential speech. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the first day of March. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. For, I think, the umpteenth time on this program, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. Today's corollary, however, goes like this. One presidential speech is not the economy either. I say that because did you see Wall Street today? The post-election rally, the Trump rally, it now has to be called, has gone into overdrive despite, and this really is important, a detail-free address from President Trump last night. Nothing beyond generalities of some of the key economic promises the president made while he was running and that he won on. Those include tax reform, rolling back Dodd-Frank, that huge infrastructure plan he promised. So what then gives? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going.
Right now, the markets are trading on high expectations. David Winters, CEO of Wintergreen Advisors, says investors have a feeling that something good is about to happen.
It's like anticipation of going on a date. Dinner hasn't happened yet, but everybody's enjoying the drinks at the bar.
In this case, a good date would mean Trump follows through on all those changes he's promised that businesses are interested in, on taxes, regulation, and a health care plan. The president's conciliatory approach in last night's speech may have given him some political clout to get those things done. Ernie Cecilia is chief investment officer at Bryn Mawr Trust Company.
He was reaching out to the Republicans in Congress, to the GOP, because that's the support that the president and his cabinet are going to need in moving this agenda forward.
And Wall Street is reacting now to the possibility that Congress will act. Roy Smith teaches finance at NYU's Stern School of Business.
If it's a year or so away, it doesn't matter so much. The market always anticipates the future by 6 months or more.
Eric Irvin, CEO of Reality Shares, says actual change could put a damper on all this excitement.
When we start talking about details, markets get confused and then it could go either way.
He says it's easier to be enthusiastic about a plan when you don't know exactly what's in it. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The conundrum of the president's speech last night was that there was a lot in it to talk about, while at the same time, there really wasn't much in it at all. And more to the point, the economic claims the president made were often not entirely correct. To pick just one, this one.
94 million Americans are out of the labor force.
The fact of it, because they matter, is that 94 million, that number, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, includes retirees and students and stay-at-home parents, people who just aren't looking for a job. The truth is, this economy is about this close to full employment. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
Michael Ayrton is a CEO. He runs Connex Brands and the Rodon Group in Pennsylvania. They make high-precision plastic parts and, among many other things, Lincoln Logs.
We've definitely seen a tightening in the labor market over, I'd say, the last certainly 12 to 18 months.
From engineers to quality control supervisors to skilled machine operators.
You're getting qualified candidates in, but if you're not acting quickly, that person's only on the market for a few days or a couple of weeks at most.
He says a lot of companies like his are actually paying extra to use headhunters. Tim Sackett runs just such a staffing firm called HRU Technical Resources.
Anyone that has technical skills right now has their pick of jobs for sure.
He says it's taking longer to fill positions because there's more openings than there are candidates.
It's a real problem and it continues to get worse.
But there is a puzzle here when you look at the economy as a whole. Joe Minerick is with the conference board.
We really have not seen the kind of strength in wage growth that you would have expected with an unemployment rate this low.
Yes, wages are rising for engineers and IT workers, and the labor market's tightening in healthcare and retail and trade. But for certain workers, not so much. And that's dragging down the overall numbers.
A part of our labor force is being left behind.
Unskilled labor has lost a lot of ground to competition overseas and to machines.
A number of the areas where the economy is expanding are sectors where productivity is improving and we can produce more with less labor.
The unskilled laborer looking for a job, or the one who's stopped even trying, people President Trump likes to point to, they're having a different experience from the IT engineer. So yeah, the labor market is definitely tightening, but not for everyone. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
I gotta tell y'all, Dow 20,000 is so yesterday, people. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The internet being what it is, a very, nay, extremely unflattering video of Uber CEO Travis Kalanick is making the rounds. Bloomberg got it first. It's another black mark for the company in a recent string of them. As I do with everything Silicon Valley, we got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so remind us what happened here with this video.
So this is a video that was taped on Super Bowl Sunday inside an Uber car, and it is the Uber driver, who apparently has been driving for the company for a long time, getting into an argument with CEO Travis Kalanick. It starts out as a fairly reasonable conversation. The driver's saying, look, you've really changed the fare structure and I take home a lot less money. And we're going to play a little bit of tape from the video. It's a little hard to make out and there's some cursing that we're going to bleep. But he's blowing his stack.
You keep changing every day.
What have I changed about black?
Huh?
What have
you
I changed
the whole business.
What?
You dropped the prices.
On black?
Yes, you did.
Did
with $20.
We
started with $20.
You know what?
How much is the mile now? $2.75?
You know what?
What?
Some people don't like to take responsibility for their
responsibility.
They blame everything
but
in their
you
life on somebody
an
else.
Email for town cars?
Good luck.
Good luck to you, too. But I know you don't gonna go far.
So that got a little testy, right? And It's the CEO of the company with a pseudo-employee, I suppose. Not the first time that Travis Kalanick has been, his reputation has gotten sort of him in trouble.
Absolutely. This is, though, the first time that we've seen Travis sort of try to address issues at Uber in various ways, but it's all coming to a head right now. There have obviously been allegations of sexual harassment and discrimination at the company, in addition to allegations of really extreme kind of professional dysfunction. You had two investors recently write an open letter, and this never happens. You really never see investors openly criticize the companies that they're a part of, that they're invested in. And they wrote an open letter saying the company has a culture that's plagued with disrespect and cliques and lack of diversity and tolerance for bullying and harassment. Now you have Travis Kalanick taking this step of apologizing for his behavior in that car, but also saying, I'm going to try to get help with my leadership.
Yeah, he says, this is the first time I've been willing to admit that I need leadership help. What do you suppose that means?
You could argue it should maybe refer to anger management, but it probably means coaching. What often happens with founders of companies like this, right, is that they have an idea for a company. They have lots of ideas for how to grow it, but they don't get training.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get, sensitivity. Look, I have an uncle who became the CEO of a bank, and when he was being elevated to that position, he went through all kinds of sensitivity training and actual management technique training. I'm not sure the extent to which that has occurred for Travis Kalanick or a lot of the founders of what are now very large companies and no longer startups, but they take it all so personally. That it can sometimes, and I'm not sure that Travis has earned a ton of benefit of the doubt. But what does happen is that people who are so personally invested and whose personal brands are so inextricably linked with their companies is they take it really personally and they have a hard time detaching. And some of that inability to detach means the company can't run very well.
Right. Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent talking about Uber and its continuing issues, I guess. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Molly and I talked about Uber and the president's speech last night as well in today's episode of Make Me Smart, the new podcast we're working on. Check it out, marketplace.org/makemesmart. One of the few areas where the president went beyond generalities last night was healthcare. He said Congress ought to give states the flexibility they need with Medicaid to make sure nobody's left out. Medicaid, remember, is the government health program that serves 70 million people, low-income Americans mostly. The politics of this are interesting because more than half of Medicaid's half-trillion-dollar budget comes from Washington. States cover the rest, and that's obviously a lot of cash for the states to lose. So it could come to pass that Republicans in Washington will be making life difficult for Republicans in state capitals. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Under Obamacare, 31 states expanded their Medicaid programs, ultimately to 11 million new people. And because Washington's picked up nearly all the costs, it's been like a tidal wave of money crashing onto state shores.
We're very fortunate to have $2.5 billion to coming into a state like Kentucky.
That's Dr. Eric Loy, who runs health centers in rural Kentucky that serve lots of people on Medicaid. He says, think of the money as an economic stimulus package.
If you look before the Affordable Care Act, there was four or five hospitals that were in bankruptcy in Kentucky. And now the hospitals, they've stabilized. The pharmacies have stabilized. Outpatient clinics have stabilized.
A recent major Kaiser Family Foundation review found that Medicaid expansion has been good economically for at least about half the states that chose to expand. University of Michigan economist Helen Levy says when 600,000 more people got insurance in her state, good things started happening.
They've got Medicaid, so the clinic is getting paid more. But also the sandwich shop next door to the clinic is selling more sandwiches because the clinic is doing more business.
All those sandwiches need people to sell them.
That translates into about 30,000 additional jobs in the state of Michigan every year.
All this helps explain why some governors in blue and red states have balked at the emerging House GOP plan that significantly scales back expansion. It doesn't kill funding completely, but that huge wave of cash sure shrinks. And, says Lanhee Chen with the Hoover Institute, the plan puts the entire $550 billion Medicaid program, expansion and all, on a diet.
The goal here is to cap the federal contribution over time.
Republicans have long believed Medicaid costs too much. And it's true. The program grows faster than the national economy. And it's always one of the most expensive line items for states. The thinking, says Chen, is that belt tightening will help states do more with less.
For states, sometimes when they have this fiscal pressure, it allows them to streamline the program. It allows them to make their program more responsive. But I don't think that anybody should make the claim that this is going to be easy for states.
Certainly, states are going to have to make some hard choices, and they all involve cutting. Cutting the number of people on the rolls, cutting the services provided, cutting how much they pay doctors and hospitals. It's not a pretty picture. Last week, Republican Governor John Kasich met with President Trump to talk health policy. In his state, Ohio, 700,000 people have gained coverage under the expansion. Here he is last weekend on Face the Nation.
Where do the mentally ill go? Where do the drug addicted go? The Republicans can do what they want, but at the end of the day, I'm going to stand up for the people that wouldn't have the coverage if they don't get this thing right.
The point to keep in mind is that the proposal coming from the House is just that, a proposal. To governors like Kasich, this is less a plan than the starting point for negotiations with high stakes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Companies don't like uncertainty. Travelers don't like uncertainty.
Yeah, you got that right. The guy who runs Expedia straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, man. Been a while since we've heard the really happy music, huh? Dow Industrial's up 303 points today, 1.5%, 21,115. The NASDAQ up 78 points, 1.3%, 5904. The S&P 500 gained 32 points, also 1.3%. 23 and 95 there. All that confidence means an interest rate hike is even more likely, so said New York Federal Reserve Head William Dudley and me also. That pushed up bank stocks. Dudley, not me. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 3.25%. Bank of America gained 3.6%. Today on the home front, we've been doing a bunch of DIY. Apparently Lowe's spruced up its share price, adding 9.5% with better-than-expected earnings and a planned expansion of 35 stores. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. President Trump talked again in generalities last night about his philosophy on foreign affairs.
My job is not to represent the world. My job is to represent the United States of America.
The president did say he supports NATO, but he said again that our allies have to meet their financial commitments to that organization. The president has talked in the past about cutting American funding to a lot of international organizations, funding on which they depend to survive. So what happens if that happens? Ashley Montite has that one.
Back in 1953, President Eisenhower addressed the United Nations General Assembly.
I know that the American people share my deep belief that if a danger exists in the world, it is a danger shared by all.
That was then. Today's president is more skeptical that the U.S. should take on other nations' problems. And over the years, plenty of people have come to see the U.N. as an unwieldy bureaucracy that doesn't always live up to its mission. John MacArthur is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. News came out in January that the administration might consider cutting as much as 40% of U.N. funding, though there's been no official decision. MacArthur says such a large cut could be disastrous, depending on which agencies saw their budget slashed. He says take the World Food Programme.
The U.S. gives about 40% of the budget, so if you cut 40% by 40%, that would work out to roughly 12 million people a year not getting access to food support.
He says it's hard for Americans to see the benefits of the UN because they're largely invisible. He says the UN's many agencies help make the world safer by providing everything from poverty relief to vaccinations. And then there are UN peacekeeping troops stationed in trouble spots.
A lot of this is about investing in burden sharing with other parts of the world. And it's also about risk mitigation to avoid much worse conflagrations of conflict that would, you know, be much more painful for societies, both in the U.S. and around the world.
But Brett Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation says UN peacekeepers aren't necessarily good value for money. He points to reports last year that in South Sudan, UN troops refused to help as local fighters attacked and raped civilians. Former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon responded by firing the then commander of those peacekeepers.
Are we getting what we will be expect and should expect from those peacekeeping operations, considering the presence there and the expense that the international community is providing in order to support those operations?
He says it's no bad thing to check how U.S. funds are being used.
I think the United States should periodically do an assessment of contributions to international organizations to make sure that those contributions are getting value for U.S. taxpayer dollars.
Nathan Sheets agrees that's every administration's prerogative. He's a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Until recently, he was Undersecretary for International Affairs at the Treasury under President Obama. He says at the end of last year, the U.S. and many other countries pledged $75 billion to the World Bank's International Development Association. The idea is to help poor countries with things like healthcare, clean water, and teacher training. And now the new administration and Congress will have to evaluate that pledge and decide whether to follow through on the U.S. contribution.
And I see that as being an enormous decision, and probably in this space of the international financial institutions, the first real dollars and cents decision that the new administration will need to make.
Why should we care? He says if poorer countries struggle economically, political instability may increase, and their money woes lead to a more lethargic global economy.
Which means less sales abroad for U.S. firms and companies, potentially less employment in the United States, and slower growth here at home.
Sheets says we are all connected, whether we like it or not. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If you've ever searched for plane tickets online, you've surely clicked past Expedia or maybe one of the other companies they own, Travelocity or Orbitz or Trivago. Dara Khosrowshahi is the CEO of Expedia, has been since 2005. Today, though, he is our conversation from the corner office. Dara, it's good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
There are a whole lot of ways to start this interview, but I'm going to go with the most obvious, which is this. You are an immigrant to this country.
Yes.
From Iran. You run a company now that is based on global travel at a time when the United States, by all appearances, is pulling up the drawbridge in a whole lot of ways. So the question is, really, how's business and how are you feeling about it?
Well, business right now is fortunately quite good. And as more people travel and more people are traveling every year and more of them go online and more of them are going online every year, we are in really, really good shape. I think that the danger is travel coming into the United States. Right now, if you look in the U.S., about 1 in 8 or 1 in 9 jobs are based in travel and tourism. And we think that travel being such a great job creator and being such a great export is something that is important as an economic force going forward. And it's something that we have done a lot of work in promoting. And I think it's in our interest, and it's in the country's interest to do so.
Do you believe the president of the United States agrees with you?
I think that the president, in his core, agrees with me because he would agree. Listen, he's in the hospitality business, right? Mm-hmm. He owns hotels. He believes in the hospitality business. He's certainly familiar with the money you can make, the jobs you can create. And I think that what's important for him to understand is making the United States a more unwelcoming place really can hurt our economy. And we, at our core, are a nation of immigrants. And that core is incredibly important to protect, as well as our people.
Let me change gears here for a minute. Economy's good now. Travel is a luxury. How attentive are you to the larger macroeconomic trends?
Travel moves with economy, and I would argue that it's not a luxury. I think people now want to travel. Listen, what we saw is when the economy was bad, people may have put off their car purchases, but they still went on summer vacation. And they might have taken a shorter vacation, or they might not have gone to France. Maybe they went to Florida for their vacation. But travel for us has been a real growth vehicle that's been growing faster than the economy. Obviously, the economy has an effect. But travel and online travel so far, I'm knocking on wood here, is doing quite well, and we expect it to continue to grow.
But then you see stuff like airlines, specifically United, I guess, saying, we're going to sell this super basic discount, which gives you basically a place to sit, and that's it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there's a race to the bottom in travel that cannot be a good omen for you.
I think that there's a race to choice, and I think that the internet is a great debundler. And a consumer then can choose exactly what they're willing to pay for or not pay for. So I think what United is doing, it's good. It's lowering the cost of travel. And by the way, it makes our service more interesting because the more stuff you have to offer to travelers, the better our services get.
So acknowledging that part of your job is to present the positive face of global travel and Expedia, it can't all possibly be sunshine and light. What's your biggest nightmare?
I think right now the consternation relating to our president and the executive order as it related to travel was something that was a big issue. We don't want to be jumping around taking political stances as a company. You know, that's for our users. But our customers were affected. Companies don't like uncertainty. Travelers don't like uncertainty. And right now, that instability out there is how I describe as some clouds that we hope are going to clear up.
Since you mentioned you don't want companies, or your company specifically, since you speak only for it, you don't want your company taking a political stance or changing with the political winds. What do you make of all of these CEOs coming to break bread with the president at the White House?
Listen, I think it's a choice. I do think that it is important for the president to hear about the concerns and views of others and for their voices to be heard. I think it's a choice. It's an individual choice as to CEO whether they want to go or they don't want to go, whether they want to be seen in that photo op. I'm certainly not one to judge.
Dara Khosrowshahi is the CEO of Expedia. Dara, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The rest of our conversation is out now on our Corner Office podcast, including the story of how Ticketmaster helped Dara convince his boss, Barry Diller of IAC, maybe you've heard of him, to get into the online travel business to begin with. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, which in a way you knew was coming. Cheryl Boone Isaacs, the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, that is the Oscars, told the Associated Press today that she is reviewing the Academy's relationship with PricewaterhouseCoopers, the accounting firm responsible for the Best Picture debacle Sunday night. More to the point, she said the two accountants in charge of the winner's envelopes, Brian Cullinan and Martha Ruiz, will never work the Academy Awards again. I'm obliged to note here, just for the record and in fairness, that as far as we know, Ruiz didn't do anything wrong. Let us just say, as we leave you, records all over the place on Wall Street today. Dow 21-115 at the close. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.